We'll call the meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, January 19th. And we still need one more person, I think, for a quorum. And we'll, when that person comes in, we'll do the minutes. But our plan for today is to address another one of the big picture issues facing the state with regard to its budget, and that has to do with labor agreements. And I want to remind everyone that we're not talking about tinkering at all with existing contracts. Existing contracts will run their course. What our focus needs to be is going forward, what our approach would be to future contracts that are in the process of being negotiated and will be negotiated down the road. So I just wanted to remind everyone of those basics. And since Representative Lilly represents a quorum, we will now turn to the minutes. You have before you the minutes for our meeting on January 18th. Would someone move those minutes?
I'll move them.
All right. Mr. Representative Lilly moves those minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Our first presenter today is Greg Hubinger, Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And he will come forward and share with us his role and the role of the commission with regard to all of these contracts. Mr. Hubinger.
Good morning, members. And Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Hubinger. I work with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Ms. Holmes and I met a couple of days ago to talk about our presentation, and we thought that we'd structure it in chronological order, that is, where the contracts begin and are negotiated, and then talk about the role of the legislature in the review and approval of those contracts. So I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Holmes.
Okay. Ms. Holmes, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Holmes. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations. I work for the agency that's called Minnesota Management and Budget. Usually refer to that by its acronym, of course, MMB. I am the executive branch's chief labor negotiator for representing management with the state employees. I understand that you want to have a little bit more information about the labor relations structure in the state, and in particular the collective bargaining process. I thought that what might be helpful is to first talk about the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, which is the law that governs both the structure and the process of collective bargaining. And in that regard, I wanted to give you just a little bit of history in terms of when that law was enacted and the circumstances that gave rise to it. I think it'll help you understand what was being addressed at that point in time and where we are at now. Back in the 1930s in the United States and in Minnesota, there was quite a great deal of labor unrest. There was violence between employers and employees, and there was a lot of resulting disruption to the economy. And the federal government and the Minnesota State Legislature both enacted Comprehensive Labor Relations Act. 1935, we have the National Labor Relations Act being put into place by the federal government, and in 1939, the Minnesota legislature enacted its state-level version of that type of legislation. Neither one of these laws apply to the public sector. They were all addressed and focused on the private sector and the problems that were occurring there. What happens about 20 years later is in Minnesota there are a lot of publicly run hospitals, and so there were public employees, and there started to be some labor problems at public hospitals, and they were causing disruption to the service of hospitals and of course a lot of problems. And the legislature, the Minnesota legislature in about 1949, came in and specifically prohibited public employees of these public and charitable hospitals from engaging in strikes. But they also gave them a mechanism to resolve disputes, and that those are the mechanisms of some mandatory mediation and the ability to go to arbitration. I think I want to make sure you understand the difference between mediation and arbitration. Mediation is where a outside neutral party comes in, works with the opposing parties, and helps them reach agreement. An arbitration is where the parties bring their specific positions or cases in front of an outside neutral third person, and this person doesn't help them mutually reach agreement, but this person decides what the outcome will be. And those were some of the dispute resolution procedures that were given to these public employees of public hospitals in around 1950. It was kind of the first step towards expanding union rights to the public sector in Minnesota. Over the next 20 years, there were small changes that were made to the law by the legislature. There were lawsuits, there were court decisions, and what we see is public employees getting bits and pieces of the same sorts of rights that a unionized workforce has. In 1959, the state of Wisconsin was the first state to make it legal for their state employees to join together and form unions and bargain collectively. In 1962, we have President Kennedy via an executive order extending the right to form unions and bargain collectively to federal employees. So it was kind of a matter of time before Minnesota public employees and teachers wanted to have essentially what some of their counterparts in public hospitals had, and of course what the private sector enjoyed. The final impetus for the legislature was a strike by the Minneapolis teachers in 1970, and that resulted in the legislature in 1971 enacting the first comprehensive piece of legislation that gave public employees the right to form unions and to bargain collectively. That law, the Public Employees Labor Relations Act, of course, again, we talk about it by its acronym PELRA, was put into place. The first 10 years under this law evidenced some flaws, especially how it worked in state government. Keep in mind that this law covers not only state employees, it also covers all public sector employees. So city employees, county employees, school district employees are all covered by this law. But what we found happening in state government is that we had pockets of employees joining together all over state government and negotiating usually with the head of an agency on their terms and conditions of employment. And so by 1979, the person who was in my position was responsible for negotiating 33 separate contracts covering 116 different employee groups, and there were 20 different unions involved in these negotiations. This complicated structure resulted in some strikes, it resulted in lawsuits, it resulted in arbitrations, and so in 1980 the legislature came back and made some major amendments to the legislation as it applied to state employees. Instead of having 116 different employee groups, the legislation clarified that there were going to be 17 employee groups, and they were occupationally based groups. I believe you have a handout in your materials. It's entitled Executive Branch Represented Employees. If you look at the middle column of that handout where it says types of employees, these are the occupationally based groups that all employees are assigned to, and this is what the legislature did in 1981. It also said that these groups can't go and negotiate with this agency or that commissioner or whatever. It said that there was one employer for the purpose of a collective bargaining agreement, and that one employer was to be represented or in what was formerly called the Department of Employee Relations. Now that agency in the last couple of years has merged with another agency and we're called Minnesota Management and Budget, but that's the agency that represents the employer as a single employer for state government employees. Some of these bargaining units, these groups of employees, were given the right to strike. Some of them weren't. If you look at this handout that you have on the far right corner, it tells whether they're deemed to be essential employees or whether they have the right to strike. I'll talk a little bit more later, and I think Mr. Kubinger will talk a little bit more later about what happens if they strike. If you look at the provisions of PELRA, I think the philosophical statement at the beginning of it, the important thing that it points out is it's different in the public sector than the private sector because it's not just about how the employee is impacted or how the employer is impacted, but it's obviously there's a very important third party in this, and that's the public. Everything that we do, any labor disputes that we have, affects the public. I'm going to be talking about some of the procedures that apply to state employees. If you look in the PELRA, there are some specific provisions that apply to the University of Minnesota, some specific provisions and processes for teachers. Court employees are covered by this law, and so is the board employees of the Board of Public Defense. So again, after 1980, there were these 17 occupationally based units. The unions then campaigned with the employees of these units to be their union representative. There are only two bargaining units that are listed that don't have the right to organize, and that is the managerial unit. So all of the managers in state government don't have this right to join, obviously, because they are management. The other group of employees that doesn't have the right to be represented by the union is called the confidential unit. The confidential unit is employees who have access to labor relations information or who actively participate in negotiations. So obviously people like myself, people on my staff, people in human resource offices, and people, non-managerial employees who work in commissioner's offices, who see the have to implement the management perspective, they're deemed confidential, and so they are put in this specific unit that doesn't have the right to be represented by a union. We do have what we call plans that apply to both managers and to confidential employees. For the most part, the unions that came in and sought to represent those groups back in 1981, for the most part, that's still the structure. All employees in an individual bargaining unit are covered by the labor contract that gets negotiated. But those employees don't have to be a member of the union. They can choose not to be a member of the union and pay full union dues, but they are required by law to pay what we call a fair share due. And that dues structure can be up to 85% of what full union dues are for that particular union. So they're required to pay that fair share fee, and the thinking behind that simply is that the union goes to a great deal of effort to negotiate a contract and also to defend it and administer it in between negotiations. And so because all employees are covered by that contract, even if they don't want to join the union, they at least have to pay their fair share of the union's expenses in carrying out those efforts.
Excuse me, to that point, Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you could be part of a bargaining unit and not join the union, pay your fair share. Can you actually gain employment at the state of Minnesota without becoming part of a bargaining unit and negotiate your own kind of one-off contract with the state, or do you have to be part of the bargaining unit to work at the state?
Ms. Holmes?
Chairman Lanning, Representative, you have to be part of the, you are part of the bargaining unit, and therefore you are covered and you must pay the fair share fee.
Representative Benson, did you have a...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is that with that 85% fair share, and I realize that the bargaining unit is negotiating a contract for all the employees, but does that employee that decides not to belong to the union but pay the fair share also get representation?
Ms. Holmes?
They can have representation, they just don't participate. There are some other functions that the union carries out. The union, you know, has a political arm, and those functions of the union are not funded by any part of the fair share fee, but they still have representation.
Follow-up question,
yeah.
Chair? So if they have a grievance, for example, a union steward represent them through that process?
My understanding is that they do.
Okay, thank you.
You may proceed.
The PELRA law says that you can have contracts up to 3 years in duration. Except for teachers, it says the duration has to be 2 years. Traditionally, the state has always bargained two-year contracts, and that's because, of course, we're tied to the biennial budget process. As the employer, the state is required to bargain with the unions about terms and conditions of employment, and that's a specific legal term. And the best way to describe what terms and conditions are of employment are is for me to just give you a few examples of what's in the labor contract. There are provisions governing hours of work, work shifts, meal periods, rest periods, overtime rates, who gets overtime, performance evaluations, job safety, the grievance procedure, wages, insurance, expense allowances, and a number of other things. So it's the working conditions of employees that the employer is required to negotiate about. Everything else is called inherent managerial rights, and we don't have to bargain about those. Examples of what those kind of rights are is determining the policy and functions and programs of an agency, determining and establishing budgets, utilizing technology, etc. The legislature has specifically removed from the collective bargaining process the whole issue of employee pensions. So I think, as many of you know, the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement is the group that focuses on state employee pensions and actually puts together the legislation that they recommend and pass on to the full legislature. So none of those issues are dealt with in collective bargaining.
Representative Benson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question about the management right piece. Many contracts include that the manuals at policy become part of the contract. Is that the same case with the public employees in Minnesota, that if policy is decided on and manuals or publications are made, that those inherently become part of the contract? And those can't be changed then without some further collaboration with the bargaining unit?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if I understand your question right, there is a specific definition in law of managerial rights, and those words are in, I believe, all of our contracts, in some section of what managerial rights are. And that's pretty much how it works. Are you talking about other public and sector jurisdictions?
Well, if you create a manual for how employees are to work and perform their function, do those particular things, are those grievable items at some point then if they're not followed?
And are you talking about the public sector?
Public sector, yep.
To the extent that they're not limited by the contract, as management, we have these managerial rights to control policy. If we wanted to go in there and agree with the union about a policy issue and how it's going to be treated, we can do that, but we don't have to do that.
Okay, comes close.
For
example, I worked many years with the Postal Service, and there was manuals on how city letter carriers to do their job. Those those manuals became part of contractual agreements. So how they perform those things. So how much leeway, when you say there's management rights, management has, is really fairly limited.
Well, we have a great deal of, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the state government has a great deal of policies and administrative procedures that are outside the contract, and our position is that that's part of, we're exercising our managerial rights, so those things aren't even grievable right. from our perspective.
Right. Okay, thank you. You may proceed. I think it's good to get these questions to the points as you make them, so I hope you don't mind our interrupting.
I don't mind at all. I welcome it. Moving on to the negotiations process, if you look at the number of employees that we have in what I call executive branch government, that includes not only the employees of state government, but it also includes the employees of MNSCU. That's considered to be part of the executive branch. The about the total number of all of those employees is around 52,000. It varies depending on how you count employees. Over 90% of those employees are covered by union contracts. MMB doesn't negotiate all of those contracts. It negotiates 9 of the 12 contracts. The other 3 contracts are actually negotiated by a labor relations unit within MNSCU. So the faculty at the community colleges and the state universities and the administrators in those institutions, MNSCU actually negotiates those labor relations contracts. MMB negotiates the rest. We usually start thinking about the contracts run from July 1st to 2 years later on June 30th, the same cycle as the biennial budget process. And we usually start, like this past fall, thinking about proposals for union negotiations. And we solicit a lot of input from the agencies, and we ask the agencies to solicit input from their supervisors and their managers about what's working in the contract, what isn't working, what are the problems you are running into. And we try to, we gather this information to try to get a feel for what our proposal should be. I also have a staff of labor relations professionals who work with the human resources offices on a day-to-day basis. And of course, over the two-year period, we hear a lot about the issues, and so we also have a good feel for what's working out there and what isn't. And we generate proposals ourselves. And we take these proposals, we review them, we gather more information. Sometimes they need to be costed. Then my staff takes them, we prioritize, we strategize about these proposals, and ultimately we come up with a set of recommendations that we take to the governor, and then we work with the governor, and he provides his input and quite the final say, essentially, on what our proposals and what our approach will be in bargaining.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I have a question. You know, on the way in, NPR was talking about union negotiations. And when you're in a situation like we are where there's a big deficit, do you ever reopen things up? I actually am not certain about that. And then how are freezes renegotiated? Or, well, like when one, you know, we have our 3 budgets. We have the House, the Senate, and the governor. So say that the House proposes a freeze. Is that renegotiated through the contracts, or how does that work?
Okay, you have
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you have a couple of questions there. In terms of freezes, right now we have a contract that ends June 30th of this year. You can't legally go back and change the provisions of that contract. At least that's the federal constitution prevents you from enacting a law that impairs existing contracts of any sort, and that includes labor contracts. Mm-hmm. So you can't come back, or at least there would be lawsuits filed and claims made that you can't do that. So any freeze that you're talking about would apply to anything we negotiate in the future.
I see.
Okay. And to the extent it is, state laws, federal laws overrule. The contract can't violate state or federal laws. So to the extent you pass something that, like that, that binds us in terms of what we can do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawik.
Then that would make sense if you're going to, if you're negotiating for the next fiscal year, if there is something passed in session, such as cuts or whatever, then that's is negotiated in the contracts at that time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. And you asked about reopening. The parties can mutually agree to reopen the contract during its terms. So if, for instance, there are times and things that happen once a contract is negotiated that we go back, and it's usually a very minor situation where we need to change the way we deal with it, and we do enter into what's called MOUs. They're memorandums of understanding. They're just essentially technical changes to the contract to allow us to do something. But the parties have to mutually agree to reopen the contract. And I don't specialize in teacher contracts, but I believe there is a prohibition in PELRA from them reopening contracts during their term.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Holmes, I have a question about the list of essential employees on this chart. At the time that we had a government shutdown or whatever period of time it was, there was a court was set up, a judicial officer was set up to determine what would not be shut down. Did that differ from this list? In any way, were more things declared essential by the court, by the judge? I can't quite remember what, if it was one person making the decision or a panel or what.
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the word essential here, if an employee is deemed essential, that's for purposes of what happens if we can't reach agreement. Can they strike? Okay?
Right.
In a shutdown proceeding, they looked at essential or core functions of the government. And so, yes, there was a difference between programs that the special magistrate that was appointed by a district court judge, there were differences from what's deemed an essential employee here.
Thank you.
Proceed.
The management bargaining team is comprised of a lead negotiator, myself, members of my staff, members that specialize in compensation from my agency, and members that specialize, or employees that specialize in human resource issues. And then we pull in a lot of the human resource directors or human resource office personnel. We pull in quite a few of them to sit on our bargaining teams because they understand the day-to-day operations of the agency better than we do. We also have on some of our bargaining teams managers who have the particular type of employee in the bargaining unit that we're negotiating with. We sit down with the unions. Typically the state will come in and indicate all of the changes to the language provisions of the contract that it would like to make. The unions do the same. The union does the same thing, and then we kind of go back and forth in terms of agreeing, amending, asking questions about the proposals. We traditionally start bargaining in about February of every other year. We begin our negotiations with the two largest unions in that represent state employees. So we begin negotiations with AFSCME, and then we have a separate negotiations that's going on with MAPE, which represents professional employees. We have a kind of unique way that we negotiate health insurance benefits. Instead of negotiating them during each contract with each union, we have established a procedure where the unions join together as a coalition, and we negotiate insurance benefits with that coalition so that we have uniformity in those benefits across the labor contracts. Towards the end of negotiations, we have what we call push week. It's the final week of negotiations. Each side introduces what its wage and major economic proposals are, and then we begin the tough work, like you have, of figuring out the numbers and the places where we disagree on language, and ultimately we hope to reach a tentative agreement. We do bring a mediator in at that time. The Bureau of Mediation Services, which is a state agency, provides mediation services to both the public and the private sector in Minnesota. We always pull in a mediator in that final week to help us work reach a settlement, because sometimes it's better to keep the parties apart at certain points. The mediator goes back and forth, gives input to both sides, and again brings us to mutual agreement.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my question is, how many negotiating teams do you have? And is there a different team for each of the contracts that you're negotiating? And how many active negotiators are there in MMB?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, besides myself, there are four other people that will act as lead negotiators on the other remaining contracts. I negotiate the AFSCME contract, my assistant state negotiator does the MAPE contract, and then we each have two other contracts or one other contract that we're the lead negotiator on, and then some of the smaller contracts is done by the remainder of the staff. So there are five people who get involved in negotiations, the actual bargaining team negotiations. And our bargaining teams, sometimes an agency will have a representative on several of the bargaining teams because they have that type of employee. For instance, the Department of Transportation obviously is going to have people on the bargaining team for engineers, whereas another agency that doesn't use engineers isn't going to have a representative on the bargaining team.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Holmes. I was just, could you clarify, you said that you have a group that you would negotiate with a consortium of the union reps for health benefits, is that correct?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
And just follow up, Mr. Chair, what would be like the number of state employees that would be on the health care plan that's negotiated, and would those be a similar plan, or are there a bunch of different unique plans?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is one health plan that covers all state executive branch employees. It's the same health plan that you as legislators and your staff belong to. The court system also participates, and there are a number of other public type entities, the historical society, their employees participate in that. So there is a single plan, and that's why we join together and negotiate with a sort of a coalition of the unions. It's more efficient and results again in a uniform plan.
Okay. Representative Stensrud.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just rough numbers, how many total employees then would be on that plan?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the plan has about 50,000, 52,000 employees that are covered, but the total number of lives, as they talk about in the insurance business, because spouses and dependents are covered, it ends up being about 120,000.
Thank you.
Ms. Holmes, you had mentioned earlier about the process of getting input direction from the administration. Obviously, when we have a change of administration now, you probably started, if I understood you correctly, that process with the previous administration, getting some input direction as to negotiations, and now with a change of administration. Could you talk about how you handle that? I mean, do you basically change course totally, or do you continue to do some of the things that you previously got directed to do with the previous administration?
Mr. Chairman, certainly 2 years from now, we will have the same administration, and so that the input will be similar to what we will get this year. But when we have it, when we anticipate a change in administration, which we knew we were going to have this fall, when state agencies and my staff were putting together proposals, we do not get input from the existing administration, simply because the contracts that we'll be negotiating will be negotiated under a different administration. So we are kind of left to go, well, this administration would probably like this sort of approach, this type of administration would like this sort of approach. And certainly just the fact that there was a delay in determining who the governor was, and the difference between, I think, how the two candidates would have dealt with things, it was a bit of a quandary for us. And so we had to kind of take the approach of what would be the best thing for labor relations in the state, apart from the political. And then when we get, you know, a governor, we will get more direction in terms of what his preferences would be.
That's helpful. Thank you. The next follow-up question would be, you had indicated that you'll be meeting with the new governor, the new administration here in the near future to get some direction as to how you ought to proceed with negotiations. How are you going to deal with that when you may get a different set of directions or parameters from the legislative branch, the House and the Senate? How do you sort that out or deal with that if you have different sets of direction?
Mr. Chairman, the way the collective bargaining process is set up is that the employer, I represent management, I represent the employer. The employer is the executive branch. And to that extent, you know, my boss is the governor. At a stage in the process, and Mr. Hubinger will go over that, you folks have the ability to come in and approve or reject the labor contracts that we negotiate. But there's also, your role is certainly guiding policy, and to the extent you want to provide policy guidance to that process, we always pay attention to that. I think the messages that we're hearing already, you know, we're hearing some very clear and some very strong messages, and you can be assured that the goal of having the legislature accept and approve what we negotiate is taken into consideration, because the alternative becomes complicated, and Mr. Hubinger can talk to you about that if we don't get your approval for our contracts.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, because I think you will be getting guidance from the House and the Senate with regard to the future negotiations. And I'd hate to see us hate to see you negotiate contracts that come before the legislature and do not get approved. And therefore, obviously, we have to have these discussions along the way to make sure that we don't find ourselves in the situation that you negotiate a contract that doesn't get approved by the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, I agree, and there are some mechanisms for you to provide input, and certainly some of the bills that are being introduced are indicating what your preferences are. I think the thing that you need to keep in mind is, you know, the collective bargaining process is set up to be between the employer and the employees. And to the extent you want to direct policy, you do that through the laws. But where does policy become specific direction to us? And does that affect the collective bargaining process in a negative way? You certainly could come in and legislate every provision that we would normally cover in a collective bargaining agreement, but I'm sure you're not interested in that. And so the issue for, I think, for the legislature to decide is, you know, how is it going to give direction without interfering with that the agreement process that we have to reach?
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yes, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just for clarification purposes, the role of the legislature is not to negotiate.
is to have broad policy. The role of the executive is to negotiate with the unions. Is that correct?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, I think that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and this, is, I guess, could go to either testifier. Can you give some examples of ways in which the legislature sets policy that gives you parameters for negotiations, ways historically that the legislature has been involved in setting kind of some of the broad terms that you operate under?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think just, first of all, there is the Public Employees Labor Relations Act. That sets the framework, and there are specific provisions in that act, if you ever take a look at it, that says, like it says, you must have a grievance procedure. Okay, that's one thing that's included in all the contracts. We don't negotiate pensions. That was a decision made by the legislature. There are some other details, or that's the sort of policy guidance that we get in the law. Perhaps certain topic areas that can or can't be addressed.
Mr. Chair, I guess
Representative Winkler.
I'm aware that in the past there was, I think in the Ventura administration, they had negotiated domestic partner benefits, mm-hmm. and the legislature essentially rejected that afterwards. Are there other examples where we put in law that certain things that aren't, you know, kind of broad in nature but are specific terms like that?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't think of anything that's quite that specific as that example that you're saying. Certainly there are other laws on the books, you know, whether they have to do with discrimination or that control what we can and can't put in the contracts.
And Mr. Chair, I guess just to confirm, but those are laws of general application. And so I'm just wondering about the history or precedent for the legislature coming in with very specific items that limits you and what you can and can't negotiate. Is there something that's been done frequently, or is that kind of a standalone type situation?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mr. Hubinger reminded me of a specific example where the legislature has come in. When there was a lot of activity in reconfiguring how the Department of Human Services delivered its services, there were the regional hospitals, and when the decision was made to close a lot of those regional treatment centers and change that, I believe there was a provision put in that employees of a certain facility, and I think that was it was of a lot of facilities, there were specific provisions that limited our ability to lay employees off. So when there is that restructuring that took place, we had to find places for those employees to work. And some of the provisions that were put in place in that regard still are in effect and, quite frankly, cause us a little bit of problems. So when you go in specifically to address a certain problem, of course, the backslide is how does it, or the downside is how does it affect you 10 years later?
Right. So, Mr. Chair, I guess my summary would be that both parties, when they've been in charge, have done it, but it's not a very good practice.
You may proceed.
After we reach tentative agreement with the union then has to go through its own ratification process with its members, and that takes about 6 weeks, and that's where they get the new contract and the proposals out to their member, and they set up their own sort of meetings to go for the members to either vote the contract up or down. If it's ratified, then that's the point where we bring it back to the legislature, or if the legislature isn't in session, the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. Mr. Hubinger will talk about that. The only other thing to mention is, if you look at this list of bargaining units and it denotes which ones are essential, if we don't reach agreement with AFSCME, MAPE, or we have a very small bargaining unit that represents the teachers at the Faribault Academies and the teachers in some of our institutions. If we don't reach agreement with them and we get to the point where there's just no agreement, those unions do have the right to strike. All of the other unions, if we don't reach agreement with them, they have the right to take, essentially it's usually the remaining issues that we can't agree on, to an outside neutral arbitrator. And that arbitrator will make the decision. And very frequently, or almost always, when that does occur, it's the wage issue. They don't agree with the we can't reach agreement on the wage issue, and so an outside neutral party makes that decision. And it happens, I wouldn't say infrequently, it happens with the correctional guard unit and the nurses unit. It has happened several times in the past. I think that's all I have to offer so far. So
let's see if there are some questions before Mr. Hubinger proceeds. Representative Kahn.
Mm-hmm. Is there an intention to look at more business-friendly practices and negotiations, and perhaps emulate the large businesses in the state? Is that something that you think, to use them as sort of guides in negotiations? Is that a thought?
That is not something that I'm contemplating, or that we're contemplating or talking about. Obviously.
I've just been reading all the press releases about business friendly and more business wise and so forth.
Well, that's not an issue that I've discussed with anyone. So, Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier now, I'm, again, new to the committee, new to some of these issues. So if you play out sort of the scenario we've been talking about, you guys reach agreement, it's ratified by the unions, comes to the legislature, and it fails, then what happens? What's in place?
Do you
Ms. Holmes?
Address that in your presentation? I can certainly answer.
He's going to
get into the details about what takes place in that scenario.
Okay. So he's going to present as well.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure. Were you going to discuss the graph with the nice chart on it, or?
I believe Mr. Hubinger is
okay.
Then
I'll wait until then. Thank you.
Okay. Well, maybe we should have the next presentation here, and then we'll follow up with additional questions. So, Mr. Hubinger, please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Especially for the new members, I should say a little bit about what the LCC is. It's a joint House-Senate commission established by law to provide administrative and policy support to the work of the legislature. The commission has 12 members, 6 from the House and 6 from the Senate, and largely consists of the leadership from both bodies. Under PELRA, the labor contracts that are negotiated by MMB with each of the unions is submitted to the legislature for ratification, and that's specifically submitted to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The LCC, in turn, has decided to delegate that responsibility to a subcommittee, the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. That subcommittee has 10 members on it, 5 from the House and 5 from the Senate. There's typically a 3-2 split between the majority and the minority caucus. There are several members of your division that are on that committee or have served on it in the past. Representative Lanning, Representative Lilly are current members or served in the last biennium. Representative Kahn and Representative Anderson have also served, as well as Representative Murphy in the past. So they are fully familiar with this process. As I said, the MMB submits the labor contracts and plans that have been negotiated and given interim or tentative approval by the unions to the subcommittee. By law, the subcommittee has to deal with those contracts and has the authority to give them interim approval during interim approval during the interims, and then they go into effect. The law is structured in a very specific way. If the subcommittee does not effectively reject a contract within that 30-day period, the contract goes into effect. So, for example, if the subcommittee votes on a 5-5 tie to approve a contract, Under most rules, it does not go into effect, but under the law, since the subcommittee did not reject the contract, it would go into effect. Similarly, if the subcommittee did not act within 30 days, the contract would be implemented. Eventually, all contracts and plans have to be submitted to the full legislature to be ratified. Ms. Holmes talked about the fact that about 10% of the state workforce is not represented. Their terms and conditions of employment are determined through compensation plans, either established by MMB for most of the employees or by MNSCU or some of the other offices for smaller plans. Those plans, since they are not negotiated, can be modified by the subcommittee or by the legislature when they've been submitted. And the 30-day clock does not apply to those plans. As we've indicated, these contracts and plans have to be submitted to the full legislature at the next session. And typically, there is a bill that ratifies the work of the subcommittee. If the legislature does not pass that bill, those contracts are voided, and the salary increases and other benefits and other language changes that have been implemented on an interim basis cease to be paid and cease to be implemented. And employees essentially go back to their old rates of pay. And effectively, the contracts that existed prior to the ones that have been implemented on a tentative basis are reestablished. I point out that under PELRA, employees can they go back to the bargaining table and negotiate a new contract or begin the process of beginning a strike. There's been, as we've talked about here, a fair amount of discussion about legislative input on the front end to the bargaining process. Under the law, MMB is to advise the subcommittee how the negotiations are going, what the major issues are. The subcommittee also has the authority to provide input to MMB on its interests in the negotiations. And this typically happens more when the negotiations are not faring well. When there's a breakdown or when there's increasing talk about a strike. In those instances in the past, there have been times when the chair of the subcommittee will submit or send a communication to all of the members of the House and Senate soliciting their ideas or opinions or options for ways to settle the negotiations. And then those are collated and then forwarded to MMB. There have been other times when they're reaching a tentative agreement and there's uncertainty about whether a contract would be approved or not. Either the commissioner of MMB or the state labor negotiator will talk to the chair on an informal basis and ask, if we settle for X or Y, do you believe that the subcommittee will grant its approval? Because the MMB clearly understands, as do the unions, that these contracts have to be approved by the legislature before they can be effective. Ultimately, as we've also talked about here, the legislature can set parameters for the negotiations by passing a law, by setting, for example, or passing one of the bills that establish a salary freeze. I thought I'd take just a moment or two to talk about some of the recent data about contracts that have been negotiated over the last few years. The second page of your handout, sort of a bar graph paper, entitled State Employee Salary Settlements. This is a settlement sheet that the subcommittee uses to track the costs of labor contracts for the current biennium. Each of the unions and compensation plans is listed on the left-hand side. There's a large blank space in the middle of the page. This is where typically across-the-board increases are shown. For the current biennium, there were no across-the-board increases provided to state employees. The next column shows the biennial base. This is a snapshot of the compensation being paid to state employees, and for this biennium, the amount being paid in June of 2009. If there were no increases negotiated in the contracts, this is the amount that would be paid in the 10-11 biennium. The next column on that table shows the biennial new money. This is the accumulation of all the increases in salaries and benefits and retirement and insurance that has been agreed to by the department and each of the unions. And this is the total cost that's going to be paid, increased cost that's going to be paid during this contract period. For the 10-11 biennium, the additional cost and compensation adds up to about $39 million. The second of the last column shows the percentage increase in costs. That's the reflects the biennial new money divided by the biennial base. Overall, these contracts that have been negotiated represent about a 0.6% increase in costs. I would point out that for this current contract, that increased cost, about 40% is reflected in increased employer contributions to retirement that was mandated by legislation adopted in 2009. Another third of that increased cost was increases in employer contributions to for employee insurance. As I remember, that's overall increases and did not represent any increases in benefits for insurance. The last column is probably the most important number for the subcommittee. It's the percentage increase in cost from biennium to biennium. While in a contract, increases in compensation and benefits happen over the course of that biennium and aren't fully realized until the next contract. So employees get salary increases or step increases throughout the term of the contract, for example, or increases in premiums happen during the course of that contract. And the full impact of that isn't felt until the next biennium. The extreme example of that is if MMB agreed to a contract that provided a 5% increase on the last day of a contract. The cost of that benefit increase would be pretty small on the current contract, but would have a pretty dramatic impact on the next. And so this last column captures all of those costs and annualizes them. The last handout with the colored bar chart on the bottom is a comparison of labor contract costs for the last 10 years. The red or orange bar to the left of each of those contract periods reflects the negotiated increases in costs for that particular contract. And so for the 2002-03 contract period, the increases that were negotiated added up to about 6.4%. The second bar, the green one, indicates the impact of that contract of the cost of that contract on the next biennium. For the 2002-03 contract, there was about a 9.8% impact on the next biennium. And then the blue bar indicates the calculation of inflation, the CPIU, that was reflective of that time period. So there's been quite a variation over the last 10 years. I'd point out two particular periods in specific, the 2004-05 contract period and then the 2010-11 period. In the 2004-05 contracts are negotiated in the aftermath of the recession earlier this decade and reflected a 1.4% increase in costs for that contract period. In that contract, there were also no across-the-board increases provided to employees, but employees did receive step or performance-based increases in each year. In the 10-11 contract, the contracts that we're in now, the increased cost for that contract period was 0.57%. In this contract, again, there were no across-the-board increases. Employees received step increases or performance-based increases only in the second year of the contract. And you can see the reduced cost there. Mr. Chair, that's a recent history of the contracts, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hubinger. Lost your name, Hubinger. Terribly sorry. Thank you. I think I might have an answer to this, but I want to be sure I understand this graph you have before us. The red and green bars, we see the green bars always being higher, representing a larger increase, and those are labeled as cost impact on next biennium. Why is that always higher? Is that because of step increases, or is there another explanation? Sounded like one of the things you suggested was that we're giving increases late in a current biennium that have fiscal impact on the following biennium. Do I understand that correctly, sir?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it shows the natural impact of increases being implemented over the course of the contract period. Employees receive their performance-based increases at staggered points through through the contract period, depending on their anniversary dates or their start dates. And so the costs aren't fully paid for that contract. but they're annualized and paid for the entire period beginning with the next contract. That's why their costs are always higher for the second, for the impact on the next contract.
On the next contract. Mr. Chair, so I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, that we are in fact negotiating contracts that lead to a, that may have small increases within the biennium we're working in, but have a significant impact on the cost of that contract in the following biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, only because the percentage increase doesn't increase, but it's fully paid in the succeeding contract. Ms. Holmes wanted to add.
Ms. Holmes, you want to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, Mr. Hubinger is correct that there are staggered points across a two-year period where they get step increases, but the other thing that causes a higher cost into the next biennium is the fact that typically we give a percent increase in the first year and a percent increase in the second year. So that also affects where we end up at the end of the two-year period. So it's not that we're trying to be deceptive in the overall costs. And sometimes we purposely have delayed an across-the-board increase from taking effect in July 1st to January 1st to address a problem that exists in the current biennium.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Holmes, I in fact have been on one of those contracts that got an increase on January 1st. I'm a state. I work for Minsky, so as a faculty member. So I've been on that side of it and did in fact increase the base from which my union that I'm a member of negotiated in the following biennium. So it does have an implication, right? For you know, when you're doing negotiation, Ms. Holmes, you have to look at that base that's there, and you're starting from a higher level. So any attempt to get back to the level that existed, say, on December 31st, is seen as being a cut. Correct? It's perceived as reducing the. You know, you have to negotiate from that higher base. So one way of meeting somebody's a union's desire might be to say, let's make the raise on June 30th, and then we'll negotiate from that base for the next biennium.
Ms. Holmes?
Yes, we certainly could do that.
You never have.
We don't do that, but yes, we have to address where the base is during the next round of negotiations. That is our starting point.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
A question for Mr. Huber about the step increases. So you have a salary range by level, something similar to that, like GSA in the government or GS. So the step increases are more a longevity step increase. I mean, so for example, those are automatic step increases unless management for cause decides not to present a step increase, or are they real true performance where performance parameters are agreed to with upfront and then they have to reach those. But these are longevity step increases, correct? So they're automatic.
Ms. Holmes, did you wish to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they are performance-based increases. The employee has to have received a satisfactory performance review in order to get that increase. So they're not longevity increases.
Okay. So is there a certain amount of steps that can be arrived at? Or is every employee eligible for a step increase every year or over a delineated time frame, say the first 8 years of their employment, they are eligible for a step increase?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have what we call salary grids for the various contracts, and there are a number of levels within that grid. Mm-hmm. Those are the steps. The percentage differences between the steps vary by contract. They range from about 2.7% to about 4%. But there is a maximum salary range, and once an employee hits that level, they are no longer eligible for step increases. And about 50% of the employees are at the maximum salary range and therefore are not eligible for those step increases.
And approximately how long does it take there, the average employee to reach their top step or the top of their salary range? Do you have that information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, each grid has a number of different steps, so it could range from 8 different levels to 12 different levels, maybe some more than that, and they technically, if they have satisfactory performance every year, they could move through an 8-step grid in 8 years.
Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Holmes, I note, or I guess actually this is Mr. Hubinger's chart. It looks to me that in 3 out of the 5 biennium covered here, the cost impact has been less than CPI. And I guess the question I have is, there's two parts. One is, what percentage of total cost are health care benefits? And it seems to me that when you're talking about personnel costs, the CPI comparison is one relevant data point, but something that factors in rising health care benefits might be even more telling about the comparison of the level of increase versus the actual rising cost for the employee.
You want me to do this?
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, especially in the contract negotiations for the current biennium, because of the no across the boards and steps only in the second year for the half of employees that were eligible for them, salary increases were a very small component of the settlement. Most of the increased costs resulted from the mandatory increase in contributions for retirement that were passed by the legislature in 2009 and the increased cost of health insurance. I think for the current contract, my recollection was that about 40% of that increased cost was due to retirement. Another 30% was due to the increased cost for insurance.
Representative Winkler?
And then just, Mr. Chair, I guess my follow-up question is just how valuable the comparison point against the CPI is for this, considering it's all salary and benefits. You're not comparing it against a basket of goods and services. What's the reason for using CPI as opposed to some other kind of inflationary number?
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, we've had a fair amount of conversation with the department about how best to reflect what's going on in the larger economy, and this is the most basic calculation. There are much more sophisticated ways of showing that, and I think MMB is working on that kind of graphic now.
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it is a discussion that we have. The economists in our department say that a more accurate comparison, there are more accurate comparisons, and they have pointed us to a particular set of data that's based on other labor costs across the economy, not just the CPI. And when you look at that particular measurement, we look more favorable than we do when you compare us to the CPI in the sense that we look more favorable from a management perspective in terms of what it's cost us and how that compares to inflation.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, the follow-up question.
Senator Winkler.
Ms. Holmes, what are your, without trying to make it look more favorable or less favorable, is there kind of an industry standard or a management standard or some way that we can determine what the best comparison point is? Seems to me we don't want to ignore the impact on employees of these increases or lack of increases in this case, but we don't want to only consider that. We also want to consider the reasonable cost growth for taxpayers as well. So what's the best measure, and is there something outside of the state of Minnesota that can help guide us with that?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we do believe that there is a more appropriate measure, and I contemplated putting together a chart that reflected that, but we can play battle of the charts. I mean, I can certainly provide that information to you. And again, instead of, it is based on National Bureau of Labor Statistics data, and it is, according to our economists, a more appropriate tool to measure state employee salaries against, and I can certainly provide that to the committee if you'd like.
Question for Mr. Hubinger. Looking at the state employee salary settlement page, as has been explained today, the MNSCU contracts are negotiated separately, not through MMB, but through the MNSCU process. This personnel plan for MNSCU administrators, where does that fit? Was that negotiated through MNSCU, or was that negotiated through MMB?
Mr. Chair, that is a compensation plan for managers at MNSCU, and it's established by the Office of the Chancellor and then submitted to the LCC, or the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, for review and approval.
So it's not really a negotiated agreement. It, in a sense, I suppose, it's approved by the committee and the process, but it wasn't a negotiated agreement.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. The total percent increase biennium to biennium is lower, significantly lower, for the MNSCU bargaining units. Refresh my memory, did those get negotiated before or after the other contracts were negotiated?
Mr. Chair and members, MNSCU negotiated the agreement with the inter-faculty organization, the union that represents the state university faculty, first. And that settlement preceded the agreements with ASME and MAPE. That contract provided for no increases at all for faculty unless they were promoted to a higher level position from associate professor to professor, for example.
I think it's important for the committee to note that. I mean, those folks, the bargaining units there came out with a conservative proposal, and obviously the cost going from biennium to biennium is significantly less there in terms of increase. Other questions or discussion? Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, regarding the conversation that where Representative Winkler was going, I just, you know, usually my colleagues across the aisle might ask this question, but we're all looking for that standard of how to measure this. And often you all bring up the business community and how that is measured, and I don't know if the one you're going to bring in measures, but so when you're looking at, you know, the idea is, how are state employees being compensated that are covered by labor contracts compared to business, and is it fair? And I think, you know, our perspective is people need to make a living, they need to pay for food, they need to pay for their mortgages, they need to have enough money to support themselves, plus potentially either an increase or, yes, the debate's going to be about whether there's a freeze. So is there any kind of, do you do any kind of actual business comparison and what businesses are doing?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is a statute that directs us on what we should consider in determining compensation decisions and setting salaries for state employees. And it includes a number of factors, one of which is what's happening out in the market. But there are other factors that we're required to address, and that has to do with internal equity. So we have to somehow within our entire system have a type of equity. And what gets complicated is if you have a certain type of employee skill that in the market becomes highly valuable, how do you keep the internal equity when you have such a large, diverse workforce and account for market factors that usually don't impact the whole workforce. It's a challenge. of course, we feel the impact of what's going on in the market in our ability to hire employees and our ability to retain employees. And although right now, given the unemployment situation, we have a lot of good employees to choose from, when that turns around, the question is, when the economy turns around, are we competitive?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slaughter.
A comment to that point, right, and where we see that is in the most that I've seen is the University of Minnesota, is we cannot seem necessarily to attract a competitive faculty with other schools of our size, potentially because of what we're paying. So it does affect the workforce.
Representative Benson.
I've got two questions. One is just, I know it seems like minutia, but trying to understand the whole process of pay. For those who have reached the top step, thank you, Mr. Chairman, reached the top step, is there an opportunity for, if they have great performance, to get a non-base but a bonus pay, for example? Say at the end of the year, they have an outstanding employee. Are they eligible for a 4% cash bonus rather than an increase that would affect their base pay?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are some provisions in some of our contracts that provide for achievement awards, and those are sort of one step, or they're lump sums that don't get built into the base. So there are provisions in some of the contracts for that sort of a system, but in some of our larger contracts, in the AFSCME contracts, there aren't provisions for achievement awards. So the only way they can get any increases for performance is a staff increase.
Okay. One more, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman. Just one last, and it was kind of a carry-on to Representative Slavik's, and that is when we are considering contract negotiations, is there any look over me toos in terms of, well, that's two questions, I guess. So let's look at the other, and the first question is, how do we compare to other states and cost of living, all things being equal, you know what I mean, if we factor in cost of living in state by state, how do our state employees in Minnesota compare to state employees in our neighboring states? Or
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a question that's a good question. I'm not aware of any data that I have that takes into account the cost of living in these other areas. The only thing that I can tell you is that the annual average salary of a state employee is $52,000. If you look at what the average annual salary of if you look at how that ranks us in the United States, that puts us 20th. I can tell you that there was a study that was done by the Minnesota Chamber recently. It had the average annual salary for state employees a bit higher, but it was looking at a reasonably small subsection of employees. So when you look at them overall, how we rank, we say 20th.
I saw you smile when I said me too. And so when you're negotiating these larger unions and you come to a settlement and then you have other contracts, there's some me too going on a little bit?
Ms. Holmes?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Ms. Holmes.
Would you pull your microphone down?
Okay.
We want to make sure people hear you.
Oh, I'm not sure it's worth it. But certain states, for example, the one I'm most familiar with right now is the state of Utah, went to a four-day week, and talking to one executive in the Utah government, that was an enormously positive recruiting effort, plus a certain amount of savings, and they combined it with using information centers in their government to assure that they had a 24/7 open online government. Would something like negotiate, like looking at a four-day week, be something that could be done by negotiations? Could it be done by the governor alone, or would it have to be done by the legislature?
Ms. Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, each of the contracts deals with the concept of work week differently. Okay. And so there would be some contracts where there would have to be adjustments made in what the work week consists of. But there is room to do that in some of the other contracts.
Thank you.
Any other questions that anyone has? Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, when we're talking about comparing state employees to another state, to me that seems kind of like apples and oranges. There are things that are unique to Minnesota that you're not going to get in Mississippi. So wouldn't a better comparison of public employees to the private sector, because oftentimes we hear about how private sector, public employees are overpaid according to the private sector, which I don't think is true. And so do we do any of that kind of analysis of comparing employees, the state employees, to private sector in Minnesota, and what does that look like, and what is what's the gist of that?
Ms. Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the issue that we run into, or that anyone runs into when you compare a public sector workforce with the private sector in whole, is do they represent the same sort of range of skills? Do we have more highly paid workers than the private sector, or do we have more workers that are on the lower end? And so to make a direct comparison isn't telling. I think you need to take the particular skills and positions, look at them a little bit closer. Maybe we look at professional employees, maybe we look at engineers and compare them to a comparable group out there. Otherwise, I don't think the differences are meaningful in any way that we can take any action about them.
I may follow up, Mr. Chairman. So in essence, we have a computer engineer employed by the state, and then we compare them to other computer engineers in the same skill set. Kind of defeats the whole argument that state employees are overpaid as compared to private sector, because we might have different skill sets. And we're paying for those skill sets versus maybe a job description or a title.
Ms. Holmes?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
The other factor I might comment that makes comparisons is, do we compare salaries? Do we compare total compensation? And getting information about the total compensation from the private sector is really hard to get. We know the details of our health insurance, but right, comparing health plans is a very complicated matter.
Thank you. Good point.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was regarding the private sector versus public sector comparison, and it's been answered.
Let me ask you this. Obviously, other public employees, city, county, other public employees in Minnesota, their contracts are negotiated by local units of government. Do either of you have any oversight or responsibility at all for anything related to other public employees?
In terms of negotiations, no, we don't have any sort of authority about the negotiations that take place in other jurisdictions. There is the issue of the of salary caps and local governments, and there is some there are some state laws that limit the executive branch in how much they can pay anybody, and similarly in the local governments section, but they're different caps, so local governments can simply pay more. They have a higher salary cap than the state does, and there are some processes for input. We do have a process where they can local governments can actually ask, and I believe it's MMB, I don't do this part, they can ask for an exception to the salary cap for a particular person, and we grant those for some of the higher level, or they have been granted in the past for some of the higher paid employees at local government, in local government operations. Can you think of any other?
Any further questions? If not, on behalf of the committee, I thank you for your good presentations this morning, very helpful discussion. And again, I want to reiterate something I said at the outset, namely, we certainly understand that we're not about the business of tinkering with any existing contracts. We respect the existing contracts, and we certainly understand that any changes to existing contracts would have to be initiated by both parties, and I'm not aware of any such movement that there may be out there with regard to that. When it comes to parameters for negotiation, we certainly understand that the starting point is PELRA, the laws that are already on the books, and that we have to make sure we follow and are adhering to those laws, that the legislature does have an opportunity to pass new laws that may relate to that. As an example, we could pass as a legislature a salary freeze going forward. If the governor were to approve that, obviously it would be an easy thing in terms of the negotiating process. You just have to follow that. If the legislature and the governor disagree on something like that, obviously we're going to need more discussion. And I would hope that as we go forward with negotiations now, that we also understand the need for some informal guidance, that I'd hate to see us get to the point where the legislature has one expectation, the governor has another, and we have a stalemate. I would hope that along the way here we could have a lot of informal kinds of dialogue about what the expectations might be on the part of both the legislature and the governor, so we can avoid a stalemate when it comes to contracts, because ultimately the legislature does have to approve, and obviously the governor has to be willing to sign and agree to that as well. So I just wanted to make that point here as we wrap up, and we will adjourn early, and tomorrow we have a couple of bills, one of which has to do with the salary freeze issue. So meeting adjourned.